From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many of us lucky enough to have health insurance as part of our benefits package are paying a lot more for it. On today's Fresh Air, we look at some of the reasons why. We'll hear from Chris Butler, Chief Marketing Officer for Independence Blue Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania, Arthur Kaplan, the Director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, and Sherry Gleed, Chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University School of Public Health. Also, a new entry in reality TV, David Bianculli reviews A Simple Life, starring Paris Hilton. The show premieres tonight on Fox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military says it arrested at least 27 suspected guerrillas today in a raid on a small town in northern Iraq. They said the raid near Kirkuk didn't result in the capture of Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri, who's believed to be leading Iraqi insurgents. Earlier in the day, several sources said that Ibrahim had been captured. He's the second most wanted man in Iraq after Saddam Hussein, and there's a $10 million reward for information leading to his capture. After the funeral of seven Spanish intelligence agents killed near Baghdad this past weekend, Spain's prime minister appeared in Parliament rejecting calls for withdrawing Spanish troops from Iraq. Jerome Sokolowski reports from Madrid.
Prime Minister José María Aznar told Parliament that a withdrawal of Spanish troops at this point would be giving in to terrorist blackmail. Our departure now, he said, would be their triumph. He said a new intelligence team would be going to replace the victims, and their main task would be providing security for the 1,300 Spanish troops in Iraq. But opposition leaders repeated demands that those forces be brought back and that the reconstruction of Iraq be carried out under UN auspices. They criticized the prime minister for scheduling the session only a few hours after the seven victims were honored at the headquarters of the Spanish intelligence agency. During the ceremony, King Juan Carlos gave the agents posthumous medals of honor and, together with Queen Sophia, consoled weeping relatives of the victims. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
Police in Ohio have linked two more shootings to a string of attacks in the Columbus area. This makes a total of 12 shootings, including one murder, along a five-mile stretch of interstate since May. Police announced today that four of the attacks involved the same gun. Ohio Public Radio's Stu Nicholson reports that one of the latest shootings targeted an elementary school.
A window was shot at an elementary school near a Columbus suburb November 11th, but came to the attention of the Highway Shooting Task Force only late Monday. The shooting occurred in the overnight hours when no children were present. But a bullet fragment recovered from the scene has been positively identified as matching bullet slugs taken from three other highway shootings, including the fatal shooting of a woman on November 25th. It also marks the first incident to take place away from the highway area, believed to be targeted by the shooter. Task Force Chief Steve Martin.
We're dedicated to investigating this thing already, and now we have another incident that's involved with it. And I would be remiss in saying that it's not concerning to us.
The task force has also connected a fourth shooting believed to be from the same weapon. This case involved the October 19th shooting at a semi-truck. For NPR News, I'm Stu Nicholson.
In stocks, the Dow lost 45 points to close at 9,853, and the NASDAQ lost 9 points. It closed at 1,980. This is NPR News. Jurors heard testimony today in the trial of South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklow. Janklow faces a felony manslaughter charge after a collision that left a motorcyclist dead. Kurt Nikich reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
The prosecutors began by calling eyewitnesses to the August 16th accident. One woman testified that shortly before the crash, she was driving posted speed when Janklow passed her from behind so fast, she says it was as if she were standing still. Another witness testified the collision of Janklow's Cadillac with the victim's motorcycle was like an explosion. Prosecutors must prove Janklow was driving recklessly at the time of the accident. In cross-examination, Janklow's attorney asked witnesses if they knew why the congressman ran a stop sign. When the defense gets its chance to call witnesses, most will be medical experts. They will testify that Janklow suffered a diabetic episode at the time of the afternoon accident because he hadn't eaten all day. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Flandreau, South Dakota.
Prosecutors in North Dakota say they've made an arrest that may be connected to the disappearance of a college student more than a week ago. Prosecutor Peter Welty says officials are sure that Alfonso Rodriguez was in the parking lot of a Grand Forks mall the night Drew Chaudine was last seen there.
We issued a warrant for the arrest of Mr. Rodriguez based on probable cause that he was the individual who had committed a crime and that a crime had occurred. If we did not feel like we had probable cause, we would not have requested that warrant.
Authorities say Rodriguez has prior convictions for rape and attempted kidnapping. Police are calling for more volunteers to search for the 22-year-old university student. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans lucky enough to have health insurance are paying a lot more than they used to. This is the third consecutive year that health care premiums for families in employer-sponsored plans rose at double-digit rates. In addition to paying more for your insurance premium, you may also be paying more for your drug copays and your doctor's visits. A little later, we're going to talk about these changes in health insurance with Art Kaplan, a medical ethicist, and Sherry Gleed, a medical economist. But first, we're going to talk with Chris Butler, the chief marketing officer of Independence Blue Cross, which is the Blue Cross system that covers southeastern Pennsylvania. They just announced a change, effective in January, that will dramatically change the cost of insurance for many small companies. Independence Blue Cross is switching from a community rating system to a demographic rating system. That means that instead of all members of small employer groups being treated as one population or community, and their health needs averaged out among all of the members of that community, each company will be billed according to the demographics of its own employees. For example, a company with older employees will pay more than a company with a younger staff. Butler says Independence Blue Cross is the last major insurer in Pennsylvania to move to this rating system. I asked him to explain who pays more with the demographic rating system.
Well, for single individuals, women pay more than men in their early years. And then somewhere after age 45, that line sort of crosses, and single males actually pay more than single females. For families, it's, again, slightly different. It's almost a U-shaped curve. Young families pay a little bit more in the early years. Costs drop down around their mid-30s. And after age 45 for families, the costs begin to accelerate again and become much more in later years.
How will that affect how small companies are charged for their employees' health insurance?
Well, that will depend upon the demographic profile for a particular employer. And approximately half of our customers will see their rates slightly decrease from what normal trends would be. And approximately half will see an increase above what the normal trend would have been.
I think you've capped it at 35% above or 35% below.
That's correct. It's 35% above or below what the normal increase would have been under the old system.
So this means that for a lot of small companies, their insurance rates are going to go up 35% in January. That's a lot.
Actually, since normal trends run around 12 to 15%, some customers could see their rates increase by as much as 50%. And the converse is true, that a younger group could see their rates actually decrease.
What's kind of surprising here, and I'll ask you to explain it, is that although Independence Blue Cross in southeastern Pennsylvania has just adapted this system of demographic rating so that companies will be charged according to the demographics of their employees, you oppose that system. You support community rating. So why don't you describe the difference between the two?
There are currently two bills pending in the Pennsylvania House and the Pennsylvania Senate that would ban two insurance practices. The first would be demographic rating, which is a rating of a group according to the age and sex of the individuals in the group, and also another practice called medical underwriting. And these practices have existed for a few years in Pennsylvania and other states. Most of the carriers in our region were still using flat community rating. And once our major competitor here in the Philadelphia area began to use demographic rating and medical underwriting, we felt that we could no longer continue just flat community rate. We started to see a shift in the age profile of our small group block of business. So we have reluctantly made the decision to begin using demographic rating in January. However, despite that, we still are very strongly opposed to the practice and continue to lobby very hard for passage of these two bills. And Pennsylvania is one of the, I think, one of only two states in the country that doesn't have some type of small group health reform. And although demographic rating exists in several other states, it's not a typically free form, and there usually are some controls on the use of demographic rating. However, here in Pennsylvania, we don't have that yet.
All employers now are complaining about how much costs of health care have been skyrocketing. And that's getting passed on in many cases to the employees, or at least part of it is getting passed on to the employees. What's your best understanding about why rates at Independence Blue Cross are going up in the way that they are?
Well, rates are increasing at for customers of Independence Blue Cross, as well as all other health insurance carriers, not only here in Pennsylvania, but also across the country. And there are a lot of things that are driving the cost of health care up at an escalating rate. One of them, very simply, is just the age profile of the American population. The baby boomers are getting older, and they're using much more services than they had in the past, not only medical services, but prescription drugs as well. There's definitely been an increase in cost just due to technology. Technology advances are wonderful. The challenge with that, though, is that these services are expensive, and somehow that has to be funded. A third issue, I think, is that the form of managed care that worked wonderfully in the mid-90s is no longer as effective as it is today. HMOs and PPOs aren't able to practice the same type of care management that they had years ago.
Why not? What's changed?
Essentially, legislation, a lot of precedent set by litigation, and really just, I think, public sentiment and expectations toward health insurance. So in the mid-90s, we had very rich benefit programs that attracted individuals into the HMO and PPO programs, $2 office copays for office visits, for example. Now that there are less restrictions on medical care and access to services, the same rich benefits are actually starting to transition to benefits where there's greater cost sharing by the individual. So there's a big change there. The use of prescription drugs has taken off dramatically. Direct-to-consumer advertising of specific drugs has a direct impact on the use of those drugs. There have been studies that have clearly demonstrated that an advertising campaign for a specific medication almost immediately results in a spike in the sale of those drugs. So all these things together sort of drive healthcare. And here in Pennsylvania, we have our own fairly unique factors, including the medical malpractice crisis. The cost of malpractice insurance for physicians, particularly surgeons, has just reached astronomical proportions. And doctors will be very honest and admit that they're practicing defensive medicine, and that if someone says that they have a headache, they're going to wind up getting a CAT scan or an MRI. And that absolutely affects the overall cost, and everyone has to wind up paying a portion of that bill.
Now, I want to get back to something you were saying earlier, which is that you feel your company has been forced to change its pricing system and to do it by a demographic system, mm-hmm. as opposed to a community system, because that's the direction the other insurance companies have headed in, where you operate in southeastern Pennsylvania. But your company controls 70% of the market in southeastern Pennsylvania, so it's a little confusing why they should be driving you in a direction as opposed to you setting the agenda.
Well, first of all, if you look, we have a very high market share. However, if you look at the makeup of that market share, a significant portion of the individuals that we cover are people who are covered in our public policy programs, our social mission type programs, We cover people through our the adult CHIP program here, or the adult basic program rather, excuse me, the CHIP program, our special care program. We're one of the biggest managed care Medicaid vendors in the state of Pennsylvania. We cover a lot of seniors through our Medicare supplement policies and our Medicare risk policies. So a huge portion of the individuals we cover are individuals that no one else is looking to provide insurance for. The commercial health insurance that we offer, we have a very significant market share there as well. And we're just looking to try to preserve the risk profile of that group insurance pool. And that's why we waited for almost 2 years before reluctantly shifting to demographic rating, because we wanted to see how that pool might change. And we were alarmed to see the number of younger people who were leaving the risk pool and the number of older people who had been priced out of coverage at other carriers and were coming over to Independence Blue Cross as customers.
From your vantage point within the health insurance industry, what would you think of a single payer plan run by the government that would cover everybody in the United States and thereby spreading the demographic, you know, spreading the risk among the whole population?
Well, the idea of universal health insurance has been around for quite a while. It seems to come and go, and it seems to get a lot of attention at times when health insurance costs spike up dramatically. And the health insurance industry is cyclical, and we do go through cycles where costs increase at a greater rate at certain periods of time. I think the challenge with the idea of universal health care is how would it be funded? For example, today, state governments are struggling to find a way to fund, and Pennsylvania included, to find a way to fund the cost of the Medicaid programs. The federal government, despite the recent legislation to expand Medicare, struggles with ways to fund the Medicare system. Several countries in Europe and other parts of the world who have had socialized medicine for years have looked for ways to try to unwind that. And in fact, universal health care in several countries is what's led to tax rates that are dramatically higher than what we have here in the United States. So I think it would be good for the government to provide some type of guideline for minimum coverage and tax incentives to encourage employers and health and welfare funds to offer that coverage. But for the government to accept the full cost and responsibility for universal health care is a pretty significant step. And what typically happens in countries that do that is you wind up with a shadow system. People quickly become disenchanted with the amount of time they have to wait for services or who they get to see for services. So this secondary or shadow system pops up around it, and people wind up paying for access to that secondary system. So in the end, it doesn't really accomplish the purpose that it was intended for.
Couldn't the rates of national health insurance be answered by everybody paying a certain amount that might even be a lot less than they're paying now at their workplace? Because if you add up the amount of money from your salary that's being deducted because the company's paying for your health insurance, and then add on to that the amount that you're paying for your health insurance, it's, for a lot of people, that's a fairly tidy sum. And if people put that kind of money toward national health insurance, it could perhaps cover the costs pretty handily.
Well, health costs are health costs, and whether they're funded through insurance premiums that try to spread that risk across a large pool, or if they're paid directly through tax dollars, those dollars are still there. And for example, as a Blue Cross plan, we operate on less than a 2% margin, which is, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find your neighborhood grocery store or the person that you might buy your coffee from in the morning who operates on a margin like that. And that margin just goes toward building up our reserve. So there's no pot of dollars here. And the cost of care is what's driving up health insurance premiums. And whether that cost is funded through insurance or through tax dollars, it's still going to be there.
Chris Butler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Chris Butler is the Chief Marketing Officer of Independence Blue Cross in southeastern Pennsylvania. Coming up, we talk about the rising costs of health insurance with a medical ethicist and an economist. This is Fresh Air. We're going to continue our discussion about health insurance. I have two guests. Art Kaplan is the chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed is the chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. We just heard from Chris Butler of Independence Blue Cross in Pennsylvania that although Blue Cross in southeastern Pennsylvania supports a community rating system, they feel compelled to switch to a demographic rating system so that other companies don't cherry-pick the healthy young consumers. Is that a trend that we're seeing nationally?
Absolutely. Even in the new Medicare bill, it's pretty clear that the incentives are there for large for-profit companies to hunt down the healthiest of the elderly, sell them insurance, and leave the sicker, the chronically ill, to public programs. If you can run your health maintenance organization by avoiding the sick, or at least those at high risk of illness, you're going to make a lot more money.
Are either of you concerned that this is going to end up in employment discrimination, that younger, healthier people will be hired more quickly than older people or people with medical problems just to save money on the benefits package?
We're not seeing that very much to date. There's really been a concern about that for a long time, but there's actually relatively little evidence of it. And I think in some ways that's surprising. There certainly is an incentive for employers to do that. We just haven't seen them do it very much to date.
What bothers me about this is I think that it hasn't really been worthwhile to try and weed out people aggressively in the employment setting to try and discourage them from having a job at a particular company because they're more likely to be sick. But if you put in the mix this explosion of new information from genetic testing and you start to be able to say, he's likely to get diabetes, she's likely to be depressed, there I think you could finally get, if you will, enough information going so that companies would start to say, well, then we're not going to hire X, Y, and Z because they're going to cost us too much.
One of the trends in health insurance now is that as costs are going up, companies are cutting back on their medical benefit packages and offering less good packages, and they're also charging their employees a greater percentage of the cost. So a lot of employees are understandably really angry, both with their companies and with the medical insurers that are pricing more. From your points of view, I'm wondering if this is just a kind of like fact of life that you think employees have to deal with because, you know, expenses are going up and, you know, somebody's got to pay for it, or whether you think that, something needs to be changed in the equation.
I think it probably is essentially a fact of life. I mean, I think the rising cost of healthcare has to be paid by somebody, and it's going to be split in some ways between employers and employees in terms of who actually sees the cost in the bottom line. But in the end, I think economists pretty much agree that employees wind up paying the full bill one way or another. I think the thing that's a little worrisome is that as the employee costs go up, there's kind of more opportunity for people in the workplace to drop out of coverage, more potential for that to happen. And I think that's kind of a dangerous trend.
Well, I think the little businesses are getting overwhelmed. There's no doubt that somebody's got to pay the freight. And so that's going to fall on the employer's plate. That's how we do health insurance in the United States for a lot of people. And if the costs keep going up, and they do, some of the small businesses just say, we can't play in the system. So they begin to pull the benefit back completely. Others start to offer some pretty scanty packages of care. Where I think this goes, though, is it makes us ask a key ethical question, and that is, if we're going to saddle business with the cost of health care, is that the right way to do this? And I'm starting to think that isn't the right way to do this. No other country in the world seems to make health care conditional on employment.
I mean, no, but In Germany, for example, most of health insurance still runs through jobs. And there are actually quite a number of other countries where health insurance is pretty closely tied to employment.
But they're still even taxing those who are employed for the unemployed, so to speak. There's nobody running around Germany or Holland or any of those countries, any of the modern developed countries of the world, including, I might add, South Africa, who falls out of the system when they lose their job.
And that's absolutely, I agree. That's something
we just haven't fixed. We have to figure out a better financing scheme than saying, well, no matter what size the business, if you're 3 employees or 3,000 employees, you've got to pick up the freight. The way costs are exploding, it just doesn't make any sense to go that way unless we can somehow share out the costs in a more systematic way among all businesses.
Well, you know, health insurance is now called a benefit. It is a benefit if you work. Sherry Glee, do you think that health insurance should be a right or a benefit of working?
I'm not very comfortable with the language of rights just because I'm an economist and I'm not really sure exactly what those mean in practical terms. I do think that everybody in our country ought to have some form of health insurance. I don't think that's completely antithetical to it being a benefit of working for those people who are working and can get it in that way. But I do think everybody else ought to have a means of getting it as well. And the public system is going to have to step in for many of those people.
It's the case that you can't drive around on the American highways without automobile insurance. And while there are certainly people out there who don't buy it, the rest of us pay a kind of an additional premium to cover them. So we have this situation where our automobiles are in better shape than us. It seems to me that healthcare is a right. Why is it a right? Well, it's hard to generate it from an economic point of view because in some sense you're saying, is it worth it or do the consequences matter? From my point of view, healthcare ought to be a right for two reasons. If we are going to guarantee equality of opportunity to every American, then health is a key part of that equal opportunity. You have to have it in order to function in a market-based capitalist society. The other reason is it's a sign of communal solidarity. We care about one another. We're not going to let our kids or our mentally ill or our elderly just flounder around, even if they can't, so to speak, earn it. So it seems to me society has a stake here in guaranteeing access to a minimal package of health care. The way to do it then becomes the fight. But we ought to commit once and for all, I think, philosophically to saying, yep, it's right, and everybody ought to have it. Then we can at least sit down at the bargaining table and say, if your plan doesn't cover everybody, not a good enough plan.
Art Kaplan is the chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed is the chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia's School of Public Health. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Meyerowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, Film Starts Here, commercial-free features and documentaries, inspired by the independent spirit of Robert Redford, SundanceChannel.com, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on health insurance with Art Kaplan and Sherry Gleed, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new Fox reality series, A Simple Life, which follows heiress and all-around party girl Paris Hilton as she relocates to rural Arkansas.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about health insurance, the rising costs for the people who have it, and the growing number of the people who are uninsured. My guests are Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. Now, Art Kaplan, you seem to be interested in moving more in the direction of a national health insurance, a universal health insurance in the United States. Is there a model that you could look at internationally that you could say, this is something we should seriously be considering?
Well, I'm a fan of universal access. I'm not a believer, having lived through the Clinton health care reform, that you're going to do this by single-payer, government-run insurance. Although, I have to say, ironically, one of the systems that seems to work just dandy is the Veterans Administration system, which I have to point out is about a third bigger than the British National Health Service. The government runs a gigantic government-sponsored healthcare program, fixes prices, sets limits on what you can get, and its staunchest defenders are the free marketeers of Congress who refuse to make any cuts or limit its budget in any way. But that being said, it seems to me the goal is don't let Americans flounder in economic hard times. That's when we start to squawk about employee-based health insurance when things are going bad in the economy. Don't leave people who can't work out in the cold, those who have these chronic conditions, particularly mental illness and disabilities that just make it impossible for them to work. So it seems to me the kind of programs you want to look to are systems like either Canada or systems like France or Germany or Holland. These are combinations of employee-based and predominantly employee-based systems and then taxes that come in. I think the middle and upper class subsidy in health insurance is such a golden nugget for the haves that they really don't want to give that up. And that's one of the great, let's say, regressive public policies that have been put in place for a while.
Chris Butler of Independence Blue Cross of Southeastern Pennsylvania was saying, if you look at some of the national health plans in other countries, you'll see that shadow systems emerge, that people end up wanting to get coverage beyond the basics that you're given in that plan. So you have all these like other basically insurance companies that develop, and people with money buy into those companies so that they could get quicker service or better service than the basic government plan will give you. Sherry Gleed, would you agree with that perception?
Well, I think many systems operate very much and very intentionally on that premise. England does, France does, Germany has a private health insurance system. The question is that a failing of those systems or is it a success of those systems? I think what you might say is, look, we want to have some basic level of care that everyone's entitled to, and those people who want to buy out of that, you know, go ahead and let them do that. We don't even have that basic level of health care for everyone, so I don't think that it's legitimate to complain that other people have two-tier systems when we don't even have a one-tier system for people who are really in need.
Art Kaplan?
Yeah, I think Sherry's on the right track here. It seems to me we have the same buyout, if you will. We have people these days selling boutique medicine. So if you pay an extra fee to your doctor, then your doctor will call you back or make themselves available to you. If you pay that extra amount, you can get little email messages and communications. This whole area of boutique medicine is rapidly growing within our private sector on top of, if you will, the standard benefits. So we've got some of that. All that said, the greatest enemy, I think, of getting universal health care insurance is arguments about the ceilings of health care. A lot of people say, but if the British have buyouts and the French have buyouts, that isn't fair. Everybody should be in the same boat. I think the problem is to agree on what's the minimum. Let's agree on what's in coach. Let's agree on what we're going to have in the back of the plane. Then we can argue about first class.
Well, Sherry Gleed, you're the economist in this discussion. How would you fund it?
Oh, that's a tough question. But I think one place to start looking is the way that we now subsidize employee health insurance benefits, which is really a very unfair, a very regressive system, because the higher your marginal tax rate, the bigger the benefit you get from health insurance. And the more health insurance you buy, the bigger the subsidy the government gives you, which is completely ridiculous. It's entirely backwards, and it ought not to be that way. So that's one place to start looking. Another place to start looking is taxes. I think that to believe that you can provide health insurance to the uninsured without paying anything for it is another pipe dream that we're just never going to get to. So I think we just have to accept the fact that it's going to cost some money and just put up and decide that we're going to pay for it. And I think it can be done in incrementally. I think it can be done by singling out the people who need it most and putting your money there and then building up over time. In the expansion in the late 1990s, actually, some states really did take some important steps in terms of trying to get coverage through the Medicaid program, which is, in some sense, a basic benefit plan, to a lot of people who didn't have it before. And I think that's the right way to keep going.
Art Kaplan, how would you fund benefits for everybody?
I'd do the tax reform that Cherry's talking about. It seems to me this middle-class boondoggle that we have, upper-class boondoggle that we have, ought to be stopped. There's no excuse for subsidizing the rich to get better health care. Makes no sense at all. And then I would put in a tax. I would simply say, on your income tax, you're going to pay a certain amount of money that's going to be used as a pool to cover those who are uninsured, unemployed, or can't work. I think we've got to get small businesses pooled. That was one of the ideas in the Clinton health reform, and it still is one that has some proponents in Congress, and I think they've got to have group purchasing power together. Then I'd probably start to put in two other things to help fund healthcare access. I think we need some malpractice reform. We're spending and wasting a lot of money on that unnecessary defensive medical practice. I think it's time to probably put in some caps. I think it's time to probably agree that we're going to have mandatory arbitration on some of the malpractice things. I would like to see a no-fault error reporting system put in place so that we could weed out bad docs and weed out poor quality care. Lastly, I'd probably do away with direct-to-consumer advertising. Now, I know this is fighting words because we're talking free speech here and what you can say on TV and radio about your products, but having big companies hype their drugs. Anybody who's been watching the recent battle over erectile dysfunction, Viagra, Levitra, Cialis, can't but help thinking, my goodness, what is this costing us? And how are they going to drive prices forward for something that I wouldn't have as a core part of my medical care package?
Sherry, do you agree with that about advertising, medical advertising?
I'm not completely persuaded that medical advertising is bad. One of the things that we've worked on, for example, for many years is to try and get people to improve the recognition and treatment of depression. And I think all the evidence suggests that the massive advertising of antidepressant drugs has really raised people's awareness of depression in a way that, I mean, we might have been able to achieve if we'd put the same amount of money in public service ads, but no one was going to come up with the bill for that. Whatever the benefits or costs of direct-to-consumer advertising, as a fraction of the healthcare cost puzzle altogether, it's pretty small potatoes. It sort of hits you in the face, but it doesn't really hit you in the pocketbook.
My guests are Sherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia's School of Public Health, and Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. You're both advocating some form of taxes to pay for universal health coverage. Let's be real for a moment. In the climate that we're in now, with the huge package of Bush administration tax cuts, what are the odds that taxes would be adjusted in such a way as to fund a universal health care system?
Well, my view is, if you can convince Congress and the president that we're just going to continue to lose money and it's going to cost the federal government enormous sums of money to pick up the people who fall out of the private sector, and if you could convince them that they're not giving away the keys to the kingdom by talking minimal health insurance, that we're not talking about programs that are just going to bankrupt the country eventually. Overall, you'll be, by the way, that's a crucial step, by the way, to malpractice reform as well. You don't have to worry about who's paying the costs of harm. You got everybody in the system. If you could convince them, and I think you can, that this reform would ultimately save a lot of money and protect public programs, I think you could have it happen. Is that likely to happen in the discourse we're having now? Well, I have to say, the biggest debate over the past year was prescription drug benefit for the elderly. if you were to make up a list of 1 to 10 problems that I think confront our healthcare system, I would have prescription healthcare benefit for the elderly as 11. I mean, so it's not on the agenda. There's no constituency right now for health reform. There's nobody pushing. The most powerful forces in Washington are not lobbying to get health reform done. They're lobbying to extend benefits or to keep price controls away or not to restrict free speech and consumer advertising or not to muck around with medical malpractice and liability. There isn't much of a constituency there. So will it happen? I wouldn't be betting on it.
Sherry Glead, The Economist, do you think that there's any chance that the American people or the American government would support changes in the tax system to fund universal health coverage?
I want to be optimistic here. I think maybe the way to think about this is that we're not going to fund universal health coverage, but what we're going to try and do is expand health coverage to a few more populations. I mean, we did SCHIP during the 1990s. We did expand coverage quite a bit for kids. If we took small steps like that, eventually we'd get to where we want to go. I don't think we're about to embark on universal health coverage. We're not about to do a big program that's going to get everybody coverage. I wish we were, but we're not going to.
All right, Kevin, I've got to ask you. You said if you were going to rate medical priorities 1 to 10, prescription drugs for the elderly would be 11.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because you look out there and you look at the system and you say we have no long-term care for the elderly, no real programs that still pick up solid mental health benefits, 40 million uninsured, and I could go on. But on that list, extending drug coverage to the elderly, I'm not against it, but it's just not what this system needs. We've got prices out of control, too many people still outside the system, too much waste, too much malpractice, too much hype of the latest and the newest and the best. That's a system that needs fixing in other places, and just sort of saying, well, here's this new benefit, but we're not going to watch the cost of these drugs for the elderly, and we're not going to actually do anything about the fact that the elderly can't get a nursing home, which I think is a huge problem in this system, or home care or hospice care, or that a lot of them can't even find their way to a hospice in the final days of life. That doesn't seem to me to make prescription drug benefit tops.
Sherry Glead, what's your reaction to that?
I think, I agree with Art. I think that what we really see here is the political force of the elderly and their ability to, even in a Congress that doesn't want to be doling out any more money, to actually take their share. Somebody I worked with when I worked on healthcare reform suggested that instead of doing prescription drugs for the elderly, we just buy everybody a plane ticket to Florida once a year, and it would come out cheaper and everybody would be happy. And I think as a matter of public policy, it might actually not have been a terrible idea.
You mean
give them a vacation instead of a pill. One of the problems with this benefit is that it goes to all the elderly, not just the low-income elderly. I don't think it's unreasonable for older people to have to pay more for healthcare than younger people do. Healthcare is very important to older people, and they're not one of the poorest groups in our society anymore. I don't really see this as one of the most important places for us to have put public dollars right now.
Well, I think you've both taken a very unpopular stand.
Send those cards directly
issue.
To That's Sherry.
Right. Those letters, yeah. But, you know, one of the things that I think you really see in this debate is the difference between a group like the elderly who can coalesce around an issue that's important to them and the group of people whom we refer to as the uninsured, as if they were as well a monolithic group of people, but in fact are an ever-changing group of people with a lot of other priorities on their mind. And I think one of the reasons that we don't see much being done for people who are uninsured is that people who are uninsured themselves are not going to be the ones out there marching on Capitol Hill trying to get legislation passed to help them. They're an inherently politically weak group. Especially because they're ever-changing. It's not the same people from one day to the next. It's really going to take an effort of generosity, not just of self-interest, to get coverage for the uninsured.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about health insurance. I have two guests. Art Kaplan is the chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Glead is chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia's School of Public Health. Sherry Glead, what are some of the other reasons why you think health care costs have been skyrocketing?
Well, one of the things that happened is that in the late 1990s, we decided that managed care was not really the thing that we wanted as a society. I guess the labor market was booming. People were doing very well. They didn't like the restraints on which doctors they could see. People were getting very fed up with the limitations of utilization review. Doctors were really annoyed. And what we've seen since that time has been a series of hospital mergers, increased negotiating clout by physicians, and the dissolution of these tightly managed healthcare networks that were really fairly successful in containing costs by negotiating with providers. I think Art is right. The way to get costs down is through using consumer power. And we were very effective in doing that in the provider market in the 1990s. We were not tremendously effective in doing it in the drug market. But we've sort of given up even in the provider market, I think, since then.
Art Kaplan, as a bioethicist, one of the things you've been studying over the years is rationing. The ethics of rationing and the economics of rationing. How do you think the American position on rationing has changed in the past decade?
You know, Terry, I don't think it's really changed all that much. I think that what we do is we do allow money to play a key role in allocating resources. So if it's life-saving resources like transplants, you do see that people get priority who have insurance, who are able to pay. If you look at categories of care, again, money seems to be a driver in terms of who has access. So Americans use money as a core rationing scheme. The other thing we're in love with, and this is kind of interesting because I think it's culturally different from most parts of the world, is we like to rescue people. We don't really like to prevent disease, and we're not all that hepped up in general about maintaining people at good levels of functioning who have chronic illness. But if you're at death's door, boy, do we love to get in there and do something about that. So access to the emergency room, almost still an open door policy regardless of ability to pay. Plenty of ICUs. You couldn't have a heart attack in America without getting to a very wonderful acute care facility in 5 minutes. In the middle of nowhere, you can still get that. We like the moral power of rescue. So we're a culture that loves, if you will, pulling the baby out of the well. Capping the wells, not so enthusiastic. Dragging the babies out who fall in, yeah, we like to do that.
Art Kaplan, if you could be like the czar of the medical system and make a couple of reforms to change the pricing system to try to bring down costs, what would you do?
Yeah, I'm thinking if I'm the czar of the medical system, costs are coming down because people are leaving the country at an enormous rate. But I think I'd do a couple of things. First, consumers, you know, despite all the yakking about this, still don't have good information on healthcare. So if I this happens to me all the time. People call up and say, I've got a friend who needs procedure X or procedure Y. Could you recommend someone? Well, if we're going to have a market-based medical system, then we need to have information on how well does my doctor do with people like me, how well do hospitals perform. And despite all the yammering about this over the years, we still don't have it. We don't have basic consumer information, and we continue to let the healthcare system bamboozle us by saying, oh, trust us. My answer to that is more information about outcomes in the hands of consumers. I think that would lead costs to come down. Put everybody into the system. Get the 40 million in. Stop having everybody run away from them and try to spend money to avoid them. Put them all in. You'll help malpractice. You'll be able also to stop delivering care to these people at the emergency room door where it's completely inefficient and expensive. I think I would, if I'm not going to be able to restrict medical advertising as it's now booming, I'd at least put some tough strictures on it in terms of content and say, you better be focused on information and education, not hyping things all day long. So I'd like to see more Federal Trade Commission oversight of what's going over the airwaves. And I guess the other step I'd take to really try and drive prices down is build purchasing power into those small businesses. Let them form collectives, give them opportunities to work together to buy cheaper health care. I think small business and part-time employees, we've got to find mechanisms to get them purchasing power again. So those are some steps.
Sherry Gleed, if there was any one or two things that you could do to change the cost structure of the medical system and the health insurance system, what would you do?
picking up off Art's point, is not only do we need information about the quality of care that doctors and hospitals deliver, but now that we've moved to, away from these tightly negotiated managed care plans, we also need information about the prices that they charge. I think one of the absurdities of our healthcare system is it's really impossible to know what it's going to cost to have any sort of procedure or care provided to you. Even if you go out of network in your health plan, you won't know until you get the bill what it actually cost. And that makes it impossible to even think about comparing costs or to use consumer power. So I think that's one element of it. But I think the other thing to realize is that the cost of the healthcare system is not going to come down. As technology keeps improving, we're going to be wanting to buy more and more healthcare, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing for our society to want to do. What we need to be worrying about is not trying to bring the cost of healthcare down, because I think that's ultimately unattainable, but making sure that for individual people who can't afford it, we get healthcare to them.
You know, that's a very important point, and I think it's something I want to underline in terms of ethics power. I don't believe that the American people are angry that they spend too much on health care. If there was a pill that said it costs you each $100,000, but it'll maintain you in a healthy state for 10 years and you'll be vigorous if you swallow this today at age 50, I think people would say, gosh, I'd love to spend $100,000 to get that pill. They don't think they get their money's worth. They know there's waste. They know there's inefficiency. They know that the system seems to be charging them inconsistently for services all over the place. They even know that if they go from hospital to hospital in roughly the same part of the country, they're going to find prices all over the place. They're going to find people recommending different things all over the place. So what we need to do is make sure that we are convinced that we get our money's worth. If we think we get our money's worth, then morally we'll spend it. If we think people are just ripping us off and profiteering off of our interest in having health care, then I think this escalating cost just becomes a kind of club that we use to beat each other over the heads about in terms of where we could save money in society.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Terry.
Art Kaplan chairs the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Sherry Gleed chairs the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University's School of Public Health. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Simple Life, starring Paris Hilton. This is Fresh Air. Tonight marks the premiere of the new Fox reality series, The Simple Life, in which two wealthy and pampered young women agree to live on a farm without any special treatment or resources for a month. The participants are Nicole Richie, daughter of singer Lionel Richie, and the increasingly infamous hotel heiress Paris Hilton. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
In television, timing may not be everything, but it counts for a whole lot. When the producers of MTV's longtime reality show hit The Real World pitched and filmed The Simple Life for Fox, it was intended and scheduled as a toss-away summer diversion. It was supposed to premiere in August and be gone by mid-September, before the start of the fall TV season and, on Fox, postseason baseball. But when The Simple Life was screened for TV critics in July, the reaction was so surprisingly positive that the network decided almost instantly to hold the series back for a later, more high-profile premiere. That was smart, because The Simple Life is a very entertaining show. The rest of what has happened since, though, is pure dumb luck. Some of the luck is really dumb, but it could end up making The Simple Life the season's first major new hit. The initial stroke of luck for The Simple Life was the premiere later that summer of MTV's Newlyweds, a reality series that chronicled the daily life of celebrity married singers Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey. What it also did was expose Simpson's lack of intelligence to such a degree that she's become a national punchline. But she's also become a lot more famous, and that's a Faustian bargain she seems only too willing to embrace. And then, of course, there's the recently discovered and internet-disseminated private sex video starring Paris Hilton and her paramour of the time. Now, with that new scandal still fresh, and with Hilton's best friend and Simple Life co-star Nicole Richie making the TV rounds sticking up for her old sleepover pal Michael Jackson, Fox couldn't ask for more free press or for bigger buzz surrounding tonight's launch. And for once, the curious who tune in won't be disappointed. The Simple Life knows exactly what it's doing from the very start. First, it shows Paris and Nicole in their luxurious natural habitat. Then, before you can say Green Acres, they're off on a private jet and deposited in Altus, Arkansas, population 817. Finally, they make it to the farm owned by the Letting family, where three generations welcome them with open arms, but with raised eyebrows. Paris and Nicole say at the start of the show that they agreed to do this to prove to their friends that they could. In the first two episodes previewed, what they really prove is how spoiled, clueless, and rude they are. The first night, they sit down to dinner with the family, a dinner they refused to pitch in and help with because the idea of helping to pluck chickens was so distasteful. There's a lot of laughter at the table, but if you listen closely, there's also a lot of insults and one amazingly stupid question.
Have you girls ever been to any of this part of the country before?
I don't know. I only travel, like, to Europe or LA or New York. Yeah.
I just can't imagine living in a big city.
Definitely I could never different. Imagine living here.
I couldn't either.
I would die.
Now, do you guys hang out at Walmart?
What? I've always heard that people hang out at Walmart.
Why?
I don't
what
know.
What is Walmart?
That may be the dumbest question asked on TV this year since Jessica Simpson asked, "Is this chicken what I have, or is this fish?" At the time, she was eating tuna from a chicken of the sea can. At the press conference back in July, Paris Hilton insisted that she knew what she was asking and knew what a Walmart was and was just playing to the stereotype of a rich, dumb blonde for fun. I don't buy that for a second. Not when the premiere episode also has her asking such questions as, "What does generic mean?" and "What's a well for?" In the second episode, the Lettings get them a job at a nearby dairy, but the young ladies act so bratty that you understand, even if they don't, why they're fired on their first day. Even then, though, their ex-employer has some kind parting words. "Whatever it is you girls are looking for," he tells them, "I hope you find it." What they may find, as the Simple Life runs its course, is that they don't like the type of attention it brings. But I don't buy that for a second either. I think the stars of the Simple Life, however unflatteringly they're portrayed, will love the TV spotlight, and not just for the next 8 weeks. In some ways, I suspect, we'll always have Paris.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me?
Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics to many great songs, including One for My Baby, Come Rain or Come Shine, Moon River, and Skylark. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Philip Furia about his new biography of Mercer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Waiting to be kissed, Skylark.